Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
A note of warning. This podcast explores graphic and disturbing stories and includes strong language. It therefore may not be suitable for our young listeners or other folks who may find it disturbing.
Hello and welcome to True Crime Daily, the podcast, bringing you high-profile and under-the-radar cases from across the country every week. I'm Owen Michael. Today is November 21st, 2019. With us this week is Adam Kasson, writer, producer, director. He's done features and documentaries, including true crime content. Specifically, we're going to talk about one of his shows, Murder for Hire, with Adam and the lead investigator in a wild case you'll want to hear about at the end of this episode. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All sorts of exciting things to talk about. But first, a Maryland man living a double life in Pennsylvania is accused of killing his girlfriend in the Nevada desert. John Matthew Chapman is a 39-year-old man from Oakland, Maryland. He was arrested and charged by Bethel Park Police in Pennsylvania on Friday, November 18th, on charges of kidnapping and obstruction, criminal use of a communication facility. He may face homicide charges next week in Nevada. Why? Because Jamie Ray Feeden, who's 33 years old, she was last seen on Sunday, September 15th. A body was found in the Nevada desert about an hour north of Las Vegas on October 5th. It appears to be her. She has not been officially identified. An autopsy has not been completed. But Feeden was disabled from birth defects that affected her growth. And she reportedly had tattoos matching those that are found on the human remains that have been found. The police expect to confirm that that is actually her. Third person in this triangle here is Maureen Chapman, who's John Chapman's wife. She lives in Oakland, Maryland. The couple has been married for a year. She was surprised to get a phone call from Bethel Park Police Department last Friday morning. WPXI in Pittsburgh reports that the wife, Maureen, says John Chapman confessed to her over the phone about 6 a.m., from the Bethel Park Police Department, confessed to killing Jamie Ray Feeden. He told his wife that he took her truck and drove it to Vegas for work. WPXI reports that Chapman told police he and Feeden went to Vegas in September to look for a potential house to buy. So this is a guy that he's been married for about a year to this Maureen Chapman. They live together in Oakland, and Maryland, which I have noted here. It's a small rural town, about 2,000 people, about 5 miles from the West Virginia line. It's a very rural area. John Chapman, police say, was visiting his girlfriend, this Jamie Feeden, in Bethel Park, which is a suburb of Pittsburgh. It's outside the city limits there. It's about 100 miles northwest of Oakland, so there's a long commute there. And then they decided to take this trip to Las Vegas. This kind of speaks to some of the stories you probably encountered on the Oxygen series here, the Murder for Hire, as far as convoluted relationships, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, it's on that series and for the other series, there, you know, truth is always stranger than fiction, you find, right?
It's true.
Things. And so with this though, I mean, like the Murder for Hire cases, the theme of, you know, seemingly so with this guy is like, you never know who anybody really is.
Indeed.
And so this is a guy who seems like he was more than a double life, probably, you know, triple and quadruple.
Right.
For the various different people. And how could somebody see somebody one way that seems like they're a loving husband, have no idea that he is,
idea. And the shock of getting a 6 a.m. phone call from the police saying, yeah, your husband of less than a year did this. The details, this is alleged, of course, John Chapman told police that he and Feeden went to the desert. They were there to potentially look for houses to buy. It's unclear if he was, you know, still managing or still imagining that he was going to keep this con going. Seems a little difficult. You're going to go back and forth between Vegas and your wife back in Maryland. Maybe he wanted to make a break for it. It's all speculative, obviously. He told police that they were in town in Vegas looking for a potential house to buy. They ended up going to the desert north of Vegas, about an hour outside the city, to do a bondage fetish photo shoot. So on September 25th, they allegedly went out to this location. He tied her to a signpost. She was wearing sort of bondage gear. He tied her to a signpost. He zip-tied her wrists. Allegedly covered her nose and her mouth with duct tape, which suffocated her, killing her. And then he essentially stripped her of all the stuff that she was wearing and et cetera, and left her body nearby. The body was found 10 days later. This is out in the desert, not too long ago. It's still pretty dry and hot out there. Then he drove back to Pennsylvania. Somebody actually was driving by and walking their dogs 10 days later and found these human remains. We expect those to be identified due to very significant identifying characteristics. After all of that, police say that John Chapman allegedly posed as Jamie Ray Feeden on Facebook and sending texts using her cell phone for days and days, interacting with friends and family, although he did apparently raise a couple of suspicions here and there with odd statements that didn't sound in her voice, and he'd apparently got a birthday wrong and some other details. So one of the friends apparently was trying to sort of draw him out a little bit. They suspected something was wrong, but couldn't quite put the finger on it. Police went to Feeden's townhouse the day before that he was arrested. They were investigating the townhouse. They found inside that townhouse, obviously she had been reported missing. Chapman's backpack was inside there with Feeden's cell phone inside the backpack, duct tape and zip ties. Always difficult to explain those particular things, not assigning guilt one way or the other, of course. And John Chapman himself was a home security installation technician before he was arrested, which, obviously have no thoughts one way or the other, brand-wise or anything else, but that sort of strikes me as an unfortunate irony.
Well, I can say, you know, what I read about we could say the brand, because it was referenced in one of the news reports that he was a home installation security for ADT, which I found just, you know, particularly interesting, which is probably lack for a better term. You know, when you have been watching Mindhunter, and I've been seeing that with the BTK killer also worked for ADT as an installation killer. So
it's an unsettling detail.
It is,
thinking about
right?
These people that you're a stranger is coming to your home to sort of install these things, which we're not casting aspersions on security techs or any companies or anything like that. But that does put a certain level of uncomfortability, you'd have to think, if you've been serviced by this guy.
You do wonder. And is it something that he's, you know, are these people seeking out this idea that it's a way to get in your home?
I wonder about that, if there's a psychological profile, but I'm sure our commenters can weigh in how they think about this.
Sure.
Incidentally, John Chapman, WPXI, reports that he had been married for 7 years to another woman before they separated and were divorced just prior to this marriage to Maureen Chapman, which was less than a year. WPXI has a extended interview with this previous wife, and she said she didn't trust him and he was a grifter and he used to tell tales about how he was in the FBI or the CIA or worked for government and that kind of stuff. And again, it's sort of security minded type of person here, but it's unclear what it would be speculative, but why do you go all the way out there? Why did you decide? He apparently said to his wife, I had to do it. just checking out some of the transcripts of this stuff, but it's not clear why he had to do it. It seems that he's trying to cover his tracks. So this will never get back to his wife. Who knows what? Who knows what evil lies in the hearts of men?
Yeah, we're, you know, covering, I have this other series that we do called Criminal Confessions. Doesn't air until December 7th.
On Oxygen.
On Oxygen as well.
Sounds like good TV.
And the basic premise of that program is we look at successfully adjudicated cases, meaning the investigators were able to get justice for the victims. And these are homicide cases.
He's being charged a couple of different charges in Pennsylvania, but the actual homicide, which allegedly took place in Nevada, would be Nevada authorities to deal with. And obviously, we're imagining surveillance video and anybody they may have, if there's receipts that stopped at a Circle K or a convenience store on the way up there, but it's also out in the middle of the desert. So, but yeah, clearly something happened here, and we, along with a confession here, hopefully that'll expedite the case a little bit better for all involved here. It's a terrible story.
And then it seems the victim just, you know, what I saw was in that she had a tattoo on her, and it was from, in honor of her uncle and brother and mother that died. So somebody who's already suffered such tragedy and horror in their life, you know.
It's a vulnerable person. And that's unfortunate. And of course, go to truecrimedaily.com. We'll have any updates to this case. There's a lot of moving parts on this, and it shocks the conscience. And that's kind of the cases that we bring. Let's get into Murder for Hire and the newest episode coming out this Sunday on Oxygen, Not Your Average Grandma. Joining us now by phone is Williamstown Police Chief Sean Graham, who was a Wood County Sheriff's Detective Lieutenant at the time of the Deatra Gunhalley case investigation, which is what this episode is about. Also with us is Adam Kasson, who is a TV producer, director. You're kind of a man of multi-talents, but you're the executive producer on this particular series. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that show?
Absolutely. So, Murder for Hire. This is a documentary series that we are doing with Oxygen. It's Shed Media and Oxygen, and it's a really amazing series. I've been doing true crime documentary television for a while now, and have been fortunate enough with this program to meet investigators like Chief Graham, and get to tell these amazing stories about however they were able to conduct these operations. Whereas one investigator told me, or actually more than one, this is the one assignment you get to actually save someone's life. And it really seems to be a combination and a culmination of a lot of skill sets that go into police work. It is their undercover work. It is their teamwork. It is their study of the law. So it's a really complicated operation that these guys have to go through. And this case in particular we're talking about is amazing. But also at the heart of it, you know, you have these human beings who are affected, right? And one of the things that I found, most amazing about these kind of cases, I guess, is one is how prolific they are, as you know, from dealing with them, is they really are all over the country. And the kind of people that commit them, you know, typically, you see in common pop culture, these murder for hire cases are mafia hitmen or
people, law and order types,
law and order nefarious types that you don't seem to, you know, are not in your everyday life. But these people are often people that seem to have the most amount of advantages in life. They're doctors, they're lawyers, they're writers, they're grandmas in a case like this. And something happens where they seem to want to kill the person that often is the most closest to them, their husband, their wife, their business partner, where they once had a very loving relationship. And it just definitely, as one investigator had told me, you know, makes you think that anybody is capable of anything.
Right. And I think that's a part of the appeal and the resurgence of the genre right now of true crime is sort of like this A is the evil next door type of stuff that it's not the big glamorous stuff. It's like, could this happen to me in my own neighborhood, wherever I happen to be? In this case, this is Deatra Gunhalley. She was 63 years old. She was arrested as part of this particular show that you guys produced. It's part of the Murder for Hire series on Oxygen. This fits right in. Let's see, Chief Graham, do you want to talk a little bit about how this thing got started? I think someone tipped you guys off that this 63-year-old woman was looking what back in 2009 was trying to, I don't want to get too far ahead of it, take it from there if you would.
Sure. Well, honestly, the case was just sat right in my lap. The person that's involved with this is a guy named Frank Robinson. Frank walked in the front door of the sheriff's office, and surprisingly enough, I was his second stop that day. He had stopped at the Parkersburg Police Department initially, apparently, and then whoever he talked to there, I'm going to bet it was not a police officer, basically told him that he really didn't have anything. But really? I had this guy walk into my office, Frank Robinson, and he says, "Hey, I've got something you really need to hear." And he starts filling me in about this alleged murder for hire plot. And I'm listening to it. I'm taking it very serious. And then he pulls out a recorder, and he had part of this recorded already.
Wow.
You know, a conversation with her, not enough to do a lot with, but it was enough to make us realize, you know, this is legit. This is real. So initially, right off the bat, when I realized who was involved, I was already familiar with the name.
Mm-hmm.
We had Deatra Gunn Halley. We had Sonny Gunn. And I knew a Sonny Gunn because of some of our drug officers had been investigating Sonny Gunn for distribution of pain pills.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it was Percocet. So
and this
thought,
is
well,
in Parkersburg, West Virginia.
In Parkersburg, West Virginia. The gotcha. Drug task force already had her under investigation for selling, like I said, I believe it was Percocet.
Mm-hmm.
But dealing pain medication. So this was on September 11th of 09 that he walked in my door. And Parkersburg is a city within my county at that time. So if you're a county deputy and you have countywide jurisdiction, you can do things in the cities. Like I could go to Parkersburg or other communities like Vienna or Williamstown where I work now,
mm-hmm.
and you're covered. So I went to my sheriff at the time, said, "Hey, I believe this murder for hire is legit. This information, I'd like to follow up on it myself since, you know, the guy went to Parkersburg initially. And like I said, I don't know who he spoke to at the time, but he walked in our door 5 minutes later.
What do you make of that? What do you make of that? It's great that this guy, Frank, was not dissuaded and he kept going down the law enforcement route.
I would say
there,
he probably, I'm sorry, not to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
I would say that he probably didn't speak to an officer, maybe mm-hmm. spoke to someone who wasn't very good at their job or didn't, you know, didn't have the common sense to, mm-hmm. to grasp what they were dealing with. But I mean, the minute he came to me, you know, and told me what he had, I took it serious. Then he pulls out a recorder and has some of this recorded. And I said, "Oh, wow. You know, that's, yeah, we'll take this."
What did he have recorded? Was Sonny Gunn Halley?
Conversation with Sonny Gunn.
She had approached him.
And yes, she had approached him. They were friends. They had known each other for, I'm going to recall right now, around 4 years. And, you know, he just said, "Hey, I really, she's telling me she wants to have her husband murdered." And he told me he was familiar with both of them. I was actually somewhat familiar with Frank Robinson only because he had worked for a bail bondsman and kind of did some bounty hunter things where he would go out and, you know, scoop up people that had jumped bail. Didn't know him well, but, you know, knew of him just because he had brought in some bad guys a couple times for bail bondsmen. So that was, like I said, that was on September 11th, a Friday, and we took it serious from the start. We had a undercover lined up to assist us with this investigation that same day, or had made contact because Frank, thinking on his feet, had told the suspect that, you know, mm-hmm. he couldn't do the killing, but he had an uncle from New York that could do it. And so he said, "I've got an uncle." Oh, this is just immediately his first time that she brings this up. He come up with this character. And so we went about finding our Uncle O, which ended up being a state trooper, Reggie Patterson.
Short for Owen in this particular
Owen,
one, as I recall,
yeah.
Which is just happens to be a circumstance here. So this is a
great name.
Thank you. And Uncle Owen is an old nickname as well. Robert Butch Halley was the guy. He said as the show, I saw a couple of clips on this ahead of time. Adam, you can speak to this. He said several times, like, I'd heard from a couple of friends and they said, "Hey, you might want to, you know, your wife talked about this a little bit." And then he said, when he's talking to law enforcement after the fact, is saying, "Yeah, they told me and I asked her and she said nah." And, you know, that should. So I guess he's a trusting, he seems like a nice fellow.
Just to jump in, I mean, you know, again, you know, it's one of those things where
it's so hard to believe the person that you're in love with, you know.
You don't want to believe it.
You don't want to believe it, right?
Yeah, especially when it's right in front of your nose.
Yeah, and then
he didn't want to believe it.
He
didn't want to believe it. And you had his daughter telling him. So you had people that were very close to him that he trusted. And still, you know, it's such an outrageous, unbelievable thing to think that the person that you're in love with, that you recently married, remember, not that long ago.
Right.
3 years.
3 years wants you dead. And this is a 63, is that what she
was? She was 63 at the time of this.
63
at the time of this investigation, she was 63.
How large of a town are we talking about here? How big is Parkersburg?
Parkersburg, let me think here.
This is kind of like everybody knows each other, or am I kind of
no, Parkersburg's a little bigger than that. Now,
okay, gotcha.
I'm in now, Williamstown's about 3,500.
Okay.
Parkersburg's, you know, probably 20 times that size.
So it wasn't quite the sort of word of mouth everybody on the block kind of knew about it. It was, you know, this
no,
is
Parkersburg's the third largest city in the state of West Virginia.
Gotcha.
So it's not a small city, but it's still West Virginia. It's not a, you know, it's not a huge, it's not a metropolitan area.
gotcha.
I mean, Chief, the one thing I found interesting to, we could speak about or not, is just the idea that you have a 63-year-old drug dealer. She's a grandmother,
yeah,
and you guys are looking at. Could you talk a bit about that? Like, why is that something that's common that you see in your area?
I would not say that's common. I would say that, you know, I had several years working in a drug task force, and I had older drug dealers than that, but not on a regular basis. You know, that's not something that is a very common denominator for drug dealers being older like that. But yeah, this, the only way I was familiar with her was the name Sonny Gunn. It caught a, you know, I recognized that name when I heard it because I heard the drug unit talk about it.
Sure.
Just that, you know, that we, when we do our, drug task force, they do investigations, and we know the people that are under investigation, mm-hmm, or people they're doing drug buys from, which is one of the things they had on Sonny Gunn. Was prior to this investigation, they had already purchased some Percocet off of her. So we look at a log that kind of, you know, certain officers will be able to have access to this log, mm-hmm, to see what's going on. And Sonny Gunn's name was on that log. So, you know, she was known, but not before that by us, not before the drug information came forward. Now, because of that drug information and that we heard she was dealing, we did our own little background check prior to any of this and found out she had once been a significant drug dealer. You know, her background, her criminal record included a cocaine smuggling charge in the port of Miami. And it said it was in excess of half a kilo of cocaine. So in excess of 500 grams of coke, she was busted for.
Had she served time?
2000s.
Had she done
time
for that?
She went to federal prison for that.
Gotcha.
So when her name came up with the drug unit initially, they run a background check. They find, wow, she actually was significant once upon a time, at least smuggling a significant amount of cocaine. The information in Parkersburg, West Virginia, was just that she was selling pills. Nothing, mm-hmm, you know, nothing like a half key of cocaine like she had in the early 2000s.
Sure, but the opiate situation across the country is particularly malevolent.
It's bad everywhere, and it's worse in West Virginia. Mm. It's worse here than just about anywhere, I would say, mm-hmm, honestly.
So this hitman / law enforcement officer that you hooked her up with, she I don't want to give too much away here, but she is sort of caught on camera, I believe, offering $15,000 out of the future life insurance payout upon success. And she gives the wedding ring for the down payment. Was it her wedding ring from the previous marriage, or do you know, happen to know, was it actually Butch Halley's ring itself?
I'll tell you a funny thing about that. Well, it was from Butch Halley. He got her this
unbelievable
ring. And the funny thing about that, which I forgot this at the time when I originally did the investigation. Of course, I didn't work in Williamstown. My current mayor owns the jewelry store that ring was bought at. Oh. So,
did he have to testify?
No. Did the mayor?
Right. Well, it sounds like he's wearing a couple of hats in town here.
No, it was pretty irrelevant at the time. It was just that when I was watching the surveillance video, when this show came up, and I just laughed because they said, we bought that at Mel's Diamond House, or he bought that at Mel's Diamond House, which my mayor owns. So pretty funny to me.
I agree. So she's arrested the afternoon of October 1st, 2009. You have the goods on her. Essentially, it takes a year. She's charged right away. Within a year, she does a plea deal. pleads guilty to solicitation to commit a felony crime of violence in order to drop the drug charge, which, you know, this seems like a common thing with prosecutors, go for the bigger thing.
Sure.
And arguably the more important thing. That's a year later, October 2010. The charges go forward, excuse me. A month after that, on December 3rd, is when she takes the plea deal. She pleads guilty. Then 2 months after that, she's sentenced to 4.5 years in prison, serves her time. She's released on parole April 2017. She's discharged, and she moves to Kentucky with a new husband. We haven't heard, I haven't seen any details on that, but I did see the sort of the tail end, and Butch seems to wish well the current husband, and maybe
well we all wish him well.
Exactly.
You know, I don't even know that the current husband will be aware of what's happened here.
Well, he's
probably
going to
turn into the Oxygen Network and make a discovery himself. I don't know.
How did you get a hold of this story?
You know, we have this great team of researchers that look at different stories from all over the country, and we do a lot of different true crime television. So we have relationships with law enforcement all over the country. And this one came to us from one of our researchers. Our producer is a great guy, Chris Aubin, who was on, who interviewed the chief here, and found this story and started talking to everybody. And for us, you know, we first looked to see the story, if it fits in, of the genre and what we're trying to tell. And then we see if they want to do it,
mm-hmm.
and if they want to tell the story. And for our show, there's no voiceover. So it really does have to come from the actual people who experienced it. And it's important to us to make sure that the victim is okay with it, as well as the investigators who took us on the ride. So Chief and Butch and all the various people and the prosecutor, Pat, were excited to tell their story and for us to cover it. And so we went down and did.
Was there any word from Sonny?
We you know, our philosophy with these kind of programs is we're not interested in talking to the convicted felon in these cases. That's not the story we're telling.
Right.
We're not interested in her side of it. This is a case that is adjudicated, that she was convicted of. We're interested in telling the story of the people who got justice for the victim.
Good.
And when you see people like Butch, you know, he's a trauma victim. I mean, these people, it's a difference. And we cover these cases where they are actual homicide cases. And you tell the story of how the investigators were able to get justice for the victim's family.
The procedural itself, sure.
The procedure itself. And we try to eulogize and speak well for the dead. And it's important to us.
Mm-hmm.
But here you have living victims, which in some ways gives us a good feeling.
Yes.
Because we're not dealing with, you're not ending the show that somebody died. But then actually looking into this person's eyes, the actual person had been affected by it. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure the chief can speak to it a lot more than I can. But from our very cheap seat view of it, you know, it's powerful. And it's important to us that we respect that and that we tell that in an honorable way. And so for us, our approach with these programs is we're interested in telling their story. And we're interested in telling the investigator story. And that's what our stories are about.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Chief, what did this particular story strike you just as far as the gall of it? Or is this sort of like any other week in law enforcement in West Virginia?
You know, I've investigated much worse cases. You know, I've you know, worked multiple homicides and seen the absolute worst in people at different times in my career. But what struck me about this was, one, her age, her lack of compassion. It kind of blows my mind that she only served 4.5 years for this. She was married to this guy for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she says on video, I've been thinking about doing this for 2 years. So after 1 year of marriage, for the next 2 years, she's plotted and had this premeditated thought of murdering this guy. And the only thing that went wrong is she screwed up and you know, told the wrong person. So that bothers me that, you know, that's just like attempted murder in my state. Attempted murder, the only difference between attempted murder and murder is you messed it up.
Mm-hmm.
So for her to do 4.5 years, I was very frustrated. That's all she served. That's nothing I can do about that. There's nothing we can do about whatever a parole board decides to do, or, you know, the crime itself was 3 to 15 years. I just felt like she should have done more towards the higher number there. Yeah. But yeah, it struck me to how cold she was. And one thing in particular, when she's handing over the ring in this episode, and the undercover is telling her, you know, I want, you know, down payment. She gives up her diamond ring and she goes, how am I going to explain this? And he said, well, who are you going to explain it to? He'll be dead. And she just laughs. And she goes, oh, yeah. And she just, I mean, could care less about not just Butch. Butch has kids. Butch has grandkids. And this woman just, you know, strictly out of greed is laughing about. And she thinks that the undercover tells her, you know, Uncle O tells her, when I get out of this car, the ball's rolling. We can't stop this. Mm-hmm. She's good to go. She says, I'll be very much the grieving widow. So I thought she was incredibly cold. When she was talking about having Butch murdered.
Although she does say at one point, you know, I don't want to give too much here, and we can cut this out if it's too much revealing. But
yeah, I may have gave too much away right there. I don't.
At all. I don't want to ruin the reveal, but she does say at some point that she sort of wants him to be stunned and then the deal done. In other words, she wanted it to be quick and painless, essentially. I've seen other. You know,
that was sweet.
I've seen these stories before. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's damning with faint praise, but I've seen other things where they definitely talk about, you know, I want the guy to suffer, he breaks kneecaps, whatever. They want photographic proof of stuff, you know.
Right.
This seems to be, in what little I've seen, it was a means to an end, and that was as far as it went. But again.
You know, it's interesting. In some ways, that's worse.
Right. The banality.
You know, because a lot of these other cases that we've been dealing with that involve husbands and wives, which sadly there are many, they do come out of anger or, you know, there's something, it evolved into that. Right. The marriage started on the premise of love that turned, and maybe there was a predisposition for some people more murderous than others. Scares me to think about, because it seems like maybe it's a little bit in all of us when you look at these things.
Sure. Human
but nature. This is a woman, who is a, seemingly so a con artist, and she seemingly went into this marriage for her benefit, did not go into this marriage seemingly so for for love or anything that you would hope one gets married for, and for a guy who was taking care of her.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, she was, you know, I don't know if she had intentions to kill him from the moment that she met him, but she definitely had seemingly at least intentions of keep saying seemingly because I'm afraid of like attorneys.
Sure.
But you know, from what you see and read in the story, I mean, it seems like the moment she meets this guy, she's looking at ways she can take advantage.
Just dollar signs.
And get money from him.
What, final question about Frank, the guy that she talked to, asked about it. You know, this is a guy who's sort of, you know, if we're talking about bounty hunters and that kind of stuff, you're kind of straddling some law enforcement and criminal type, that milieu. He was actually friends with Butch first, like they had an ongoing friendship. Am I understand that correctly?
And he was friends with both of them at the time.
He was friends with both of them, but that seems like an odd choice that you would go to him when this guy is, you know, instead of, I don't know, you know, I've seen other things where people go to like, you know, they go to a bar, they know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody. You know, this is a very primary principal person in this relationship. Let's see, that struck me as a bad judgment. But,
you know, part of this came up where, you know, they said that she was out at the bar asking people about, you know, getting insulin to put in his food. So I think she was just not that smart to be, you know, she could be evil and plotting and conniving, but she wasn't that smart, quite honestly, you know, because these allegations were, you know, unfortunately, like we mentioned earlier, you know, Butch didn't want to see what was right in front of him, you know, and it took, you know, the arrest of her. And when we, you know, told him everything was going on to accept it. And he quit being a victim then. That day, October 1st of 2009, Butch quit being a victim. But up until then, I mean, there were a lot of red flags. I mean, if someone's telling me she's in the bar saying this, I'm probably not just going to take her word that it didn't happen. You know, but, you know, by the grace of God, it didn't happen. And she then went to someone else. You know, we don't know how many people she went to for this, but I believe it was more than a couple.
Chief, I guess the one thing I just wondered if you could help, you know, really explain to people, because it's hard to grasp this idea that you're actually intervening before the crime happens, which makes this a bit different, right? These kind of investigation. So really,
Absolutely. All
the evidence you have is the words out of people's mouth, right? So Can you just explain the challenges of what can go right and what can go wrong, particularly in this case, when you need to for sure make sure that what she really is doing is intending to kill her husband, and that you have unequivocal proof that that is the case, and what that proof actually is, and what can go wrong, and then how are you able to, you know, kind of keep your cool and still, you know, persevere as you did in this case, even when some missteps happen?
Well, you know, knowing someone committed a crime and having enough evidence to be able to take it to a jury and prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone's guilty, that, you know, that's a big jump. And you've got a lot of distance in there that you have to close. And in this case in particular, yeah, we absolutely knew that this woman was soliciting to have her husband murdered. But at the same time, we had to prove it. So one of the huge missteps, we had set up the first meeting with the undercover at a hotel room in Parkersburg. I was actually in the adjacent room. It's supposed to be wired up by the guys that do this. I wasn't involved with the wires. You know, we have people that specialize in different areas, of course. And this room gets wired up, and something goes wrong. So I'm listening live, and I'm not too worried about the undercover. You know, he's a big guy, he's a tough guy, and this is a 63-year-old woman. Not that she couldn't have a gun or something, sure. You know, but I'm in the next room and I'm trying to listen. And as I'm listening, I'm not understanding anything that's going on. I think the wire's terrible, but I'm still thinking to myself, I'm sure the recording's fine. You know, maybe just my feed's not good. Wait, you know, we did this on, I believe it was September 17th, the first meeting, 2 weeks before we arrested her. Our intention was to have this meeting, get our evidence, get her soliciting the murder on tape, enough for a jury. And our intention was to end that meeting, let her drive away, and then review our evidence and arrest her. You know, we thought we'd have that. Well, when we listened to the wire, it's not good enough. And you said something about keeping our cool. I didn't. I was so irritated at this point. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. We just wired up the room and met with a murder for hire suspect, and we screwed it up. So, you know,
was it the really, sound quality, or was it,
it was interference. It was sound quality.
The same issues you were having. Gotcha.
It's like, you know, you can get different frequencies that cut in sometimes, and there's been such crazy improvements in technology that it doesn't happen as much. But you know, it's only been 10 years, but the advancements are incredible, you know, on some of the wires we have now, as opposed to what we had then.
But not to ruin how you actually persevered, because then people can watch the show for that. But okay. it was amazing how, you know, you had this, you know, this technical mishap, which can happen, yeah. Right? And still, very you guys were able to pivot, re-strategize, and it was, you know, had to go through quite a bit of refiguring out how you would actually get her back. Sure. And have another conversation to be able to get her to tell you what she was trying to do. One of the things that just impresses me about how you all worked is when you're dealing with law enforcement agencies, they have a sort of an arm's length, more than an arm's length separation between the investigative agency and the prosecutor's office. But here, you all really seem to work like a team.
And we really
did. There was an open, you know, you could tell there was a looseness about how you all worked together. There was a flow. There didn't seem to be any regimented, you know, chain of command, even though obviously there is a chain of command. But you all seem to work really open door with each other to help each other make sure that you were able to successfully.
No power plays. No, none at all.
You know. That's something that's really great. We have a investigative unit that does a lot of our, you know, the majority of our drug investigations. It's called the Parkersburg Violent Crime Narcotics Task Force. Now, that is a task force made up of all the agencies in our county, which would include the Wood County Sheriff's Office, who I worked for at the time, the West Virginia State Police, the Vienna Police, and the Parkersburg Police. I left the sheriff's office in 2014 to come here. And then one of the very first things I did was I got the Williamstown Police Department to join that same unit. Mm. And the reason I did that is all of these agencies that work on these crimes, there is so much cooperation. You know, I don't know what it's like in a lot of areas. I've heard a lot of problems in some areas. I know other areas work good together, but here it really is more about the mission than it is who gets credit. And the mission is, like for that group, is to investigate drug trafficking and violent crime. So we have members from all those departments I mentioned that work together on a daily basis. So when something big happens, you know, these guys, you know, they just work together. They don't worry about who gets credit, and we just get the job done. So that helps a lot in situations like this, because you need, you know, a crazy amount of surveillance units or trail units or units that are going to do the wiring, you know, whatever. It just helps a lot to have agencies that work together like that. And that's not, you know, that's not everywhere. It's absolutely not, but it is here.
No, but the, you're right. It's not everywhere, but the information and intelligence sharing is obviously crucial.
It's life-saving. I mean, it's literally life-saving to share intelligence, you know, many times over, you know, and that's just, you know, that's one of the great benefits of technology is information sharing, but you've got to have the people willing to do it as well. The department heads willing to do that in, at least here and in a lot of places I know, you know, that's, it's not a problem.
Mm-hmm. Just so I'm saying his name, Pat Lefebvre.
Yeah, good luck with that. That's pretty close. Patrick Lefebvre is the prosecutor. Great guy. This is his first term as prosecutor. He's doing an outstanding job. He was an assistant prosecutor for quite a while, and then he ran for the main job when the last prosecutor ran for election as a judge and took it. At the time of this case, the prosecutor was Jason Wharton. He's now a circuit court judge, but Patrick Lefebvre was involved with this case back then as an assistant.
Any last elements? Any last from either of you gentlemen?
I guess one of the things that I, you know, we've seen this in a handful of cases, but, you know, you always think that when somebody comes to you or you witness something that's wrong or a crime, you're going to do something about it. And I would hope I would do that. Mm-hmm. I would think I would, but it's nice to see it when you actually get to see it happen. And when you see a guy like Frank, he is, you know, confronted with this crazy proposition. And not only does he know well enough to know that she's serious, not only does he know well enough to go to the cops, he keeps going to make sure that they know, to help them collect information, and really sees this whole thing through. And it's hard to realize when you talk to the person what kind of stress and strain right. that is, you know, on them and on their life. And it just, you know, you want to give a big credit to this guy. You hear a lot about these incidents when things happen and bystanders don't do anything,
right?
Or witnesses don't come forward. But here you have this guy who not only comes forward, he really does see this through to make sure that she's brought to
this death. Is an excellent point, because if he would have said, "No, you're crazy. What are you talking about?" You know, she might have.
She just went often, to someone else.
Would have gone to somebody else. And even if he had gone directly to the cops, directly after telling her, "No way." You know, she might have gone on the run, or who knows what other things. He kept the kind of the con going so that the undercover could do the job there. So yeah, there's a couple of heroes here in this.
If there's one hero in this, it's Frank Robinson. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely. I'm really proud of what he did, Frank. You know, this wouldn't have happened without Frank. And he came to us pretty much immediately after this first conversation happened. Well, he went to the other police department first, and then he came to us.
Even better.
But Frank Robinson, absolutely, in my opinion, saved Butch Halley's life, because I'm sure she wouldn't, you know, if she's thought about this for 2 years and she's been in a bar asking people about getting insulin, and then she asked Frank, you know, she wasn't going to stop. I mean, mm-hmm. she needed her financial security. And I really think that's all this was about. I don't think that it's anything to do with anything Butch ever did to her. You know, that's probably one of the reasons she didn't want him torturing. She just wanted, you know, an end to the means and wanted a way to be taken care of. Mm-hmm. But, you know, thank goodness that Frank, you know, is the type of person he is and came forward immediately with the information and was smart enough and quick thinking enough, you know, to come up with Uncle O in the first conversation with her. I can't do this, but I've got an uncle from New York, Uncle mm-hmm. O. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really thinking on your feet. Mm-hmm. I'm really proud of the job he did.
What a story. Can't wait to check this out for listeners and viewers. This episode, Not Your Average Grandma, airs on Oxygen.
No, she is not.
Right. The episode's titled Not Your Average Grandma. It airs on Oxygen on November 24th. Check your local listings. You don't want to miss this one. Not Your Average Grandma, part of the Murder for Hire series on the Oxygen channel. November 24th. Check it out. Thanks to Adam Kasson and Chief Sean Graham for being with us this week. Where can viewers and listeners find out more about the show and sort of about what you guys are working on in particular?
Oxygen, oxygen.com. Go to oxygen.com. They have all sorts of stuff on the on this program and other extras that we have on there that are not that you won't be able to see on the show. And then obviously on Sunday night, this Sunday, I believe it's 7 and 9 o'clock we'll repeat it again. But check your local listings as times do change. Yes, go to oxygen.com.
Excellent.
Murder for Hire.
Well, Sean, Chief Graham, thank you very much for being here this week. I'm sure that most people, if they are interested in finding out more about your department, they can go check out the Williamstown Police Department in West Virginia, although I imagine most people are trying to stay out of your good graces and, you know, will be more than entertained by the show itself.
If anyone needs would want to reach out to me, they could get me through the Williamstown Police Department, Williamstown, West Virginia, on Instagram at Chief Sean Graham and on Twitter at Graham underscore Chief.
Excellent. Again, the episode Not Your Average Grandma airs on Oxygen on November 24th. Check your local listings. That's our show for this week. Find our content on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, and on YouTube. And get updates and subscribe to our newsletter at truecrimedaily.com. Until next week, this is True Crime Daily, the podcast reminding you, don't do crimes.